big finale.
Welcome back to the big finale. I'm Bruce Collins. This is episode 6 of the big finale. And in this episode, we're going to have an interview with David Abulafia, who has written the book Visions Through a Glass Darkly. Now, as many of you know, the big finale is the program with the subtitle, the original program that started the fringe movement. The original big finale began in January of 2006, over 10 years ago now, and we've brought it back. This is now one of the first few episodes of 2016, and we think so far we've been presenting a very good program full of a lot of interesting topics and interesting content. Now, for those of you who are just listening to the big finale for the first time, we have past shows, of course, right here at ipbn-fm.com or at fringeradionetwork.com. But we also have another program, and that program is called The Bruce Collins Show. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Thursday night on WWPR 1490 AM. WWPR is an AM radio station in the Bradenton, Tampa, Sarasota, Florida area. And we broadcast there every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We also broadcast The Bruce Collins Show right here at ipbn-fm.com. It's the same program as Thursday night. It's Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern, again on ipbn-fm.com. And we have iTunes and various other places, as well as every week we post that week's episode of The Bruce Collins Show on fringeradionetwork.com. So we hope you enjoy this program, the big finale. And if you have time and you've never tried it before, please give us a listen at The Bruce Collins Show. And up next, we have a very interesting interview. In fact, it's totally unique, I think. I came across an author who has written a book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly. And there is a paranormal aspect to this book. There's also a spiritual aspect. And he has a very interesting, intense thought process. And so I thought it would be interesting to actually interview him and go inside his mind a little bit, if you will, about his book. His book is fictional, but as he explains, maybe it's not completely fictional. David Abulafia, the author of Visions Through a Glass Darkly, joins us in a moment. Novels often cross several genres, and this is the case with the new book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly, a work by a new author, David Abulafia, a New York attorney. This is a thriller wrapped in a mystery encapsulated within the stark borders of psychological horror. This work is also a far cry from commercial fiction. It is literary horror, a complex work with deep philosophical concepts to impart or at least to suggest to the minds of its readers. David Abulafia, welcome to the... I said the wrong show. Let me do that part again. David Abulafia, welcome to the big finale.
Well, good day to you, Bruce Collins. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I'm excited about this book. I actually have a copy on Kindle, so people can purchase it on Kindle or also a hard copy through Amazon, of course. Now, tell us about yourself, David.
Tell us about myself. Well, what did Bill Cosby say? There's a name in the news. I started out as a child. That's what Bill Cosby said. raised a city boy originally, Bruce, raised in the Bronx, New York, went to high school in Harlem, spent 6 years in the city of Boston, and then came back to New York. Born and raised in the city, but there was a time in my life around, around my 30s, where I moved to this little town in upstate New York called Rhinebeck, New York, about 100 miles from New York. And I have to tell you, when I did that, and I did that for employment purposes at the time, I got an entirely different perspective on my life. So here it is, you take a city boy from the streets of New York, really from the inner city, and you dump him into the countryside, into the mountains. And so what happened to me after that was that I had a dual perspective, a perspective of a city kid that now has a love of nature and solitude and quiet. And these two, this kind of dichotomous living arrangement changed me, and it changed the way I looked at everything. You know, I went through several careers through my life. I started out as an advertising copywriter. I went into the field of public relations, where I worked for a school, which, as you may know, is the basis for the novel, which takes place in a school. From there, I wound up running schools, and not only running schools, but reorganizing failing private schools for about a decade, until finally I was doing so much law that I just became a lawyer. And that was nearly two decades ago now. So, you know, I've been a lawyer for a long time, always wanted to write a book, wrote my entire life, but never a book. And in 2004, I began Visions Through a Glass Darkly, basically to see if I could do it. And now I find myself an author and writing all the time and cranking out novels, or at least attempting to.
Yeah. And great work. But you also wrote a book called Snapshots from an Uneventful Life. And I know there were some philosophical ponderings within the confines of that book, too. Tell us what that book is about, Snapshots from an Uneventful Life.
Well, Snapshots was written immediately after I finished Visions, and it is a dramatically different kind of book. First of all, it's a collection of essays in a memoir format. These are true stories, and just as the title would suggest, they're nothing more or less than bits and pieces of some of the crazy things that occurred to me in my life. But a little bit more than that. Look, there's I'm a Gemini, and I'm a true Gemini in many respects. So I have this incredible dark side to me, which you get to see in Visions, and in Snapshots you see the other side. I like to think, although I didn't know until people told me, quite frankly, that it's basically mostly hysterical. It was written kind of to allow my kids and my grandkids and my great-grandkids, who I'll never know, to allow them to know me, to get deep inside me, to see some of the stupid things that I did. And it was a book that was written for everyone. It has no profanity. It has no violence. It has no sex. It has no politics or religion. I mean, I don't know how it's going to garner anyone's interest, but basically it was written for everyone, so that everyone could identify with it. But, you know, beyond me playing a clown, which is what I do for most of the book, you know, there are some very, what I like to think are very, okay, philosophical or poignant pieces to this book. I mean, things that put me, for lack of a better phrase, that put me in touch with the spirit world. It put me in touch with God. I tell a story of walking along a beach in St. Martin on vacation. I was just walking along a beach all by myself in a very despondent mood. And I was determined to get out of this mood. I didn't know why I was in it, but I was very depressed, literally. And I just kept talking to myself and saying, you know, in a few steps, this is all going to be over. I'm going to have whatever questions I have in my head, I'm going to have an answer to. And I kept walking and talking this phrase over and over. I'm going to, any step now, I'm going to have my answers in any step. And at that moment, Bruce, I just happened to look down. And I'm on a beach, and I spot a shell, a little fragment of a shell, and I reach down, and I pick it up. And it's a beautiful shell. It's beautiful in its color. It's beautiful in its shape. And I simply remark to myself, how beautiful. Hmm. And Bruce, at that moment, that was the answer that I was looking for. And the answer that I interpreted from that very simple event was that we're surrounded by the beauty of this world. And that very often we allow our problems to interfere with our clear vision. And sometimes all we need to do is to simply open our eyes, to see the music of the spheres, to see the beauty that surrounds us at all times. And, okay, so that's a part of what you'll get in Snapshot.
That alone is well worth getting it. I actually needed to hear that today with my 9-to-5. Very crazy things going on there. Now, your new book is Visions Through a Glass Darkly. Great book. And you take some interesting journeys through this book. Give us an overview of this book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly by David Abulafia.
Yes. Well, you know, this book actually started out as two books that I combined into one. So in 2004, this is a book that took me 10 years to write, okay? And this was my first novel. I had written my whole life, but I had never really attempted a book before. And I, quite frankly, I didn't know if I could do it, okay? I had been a short story writer my whole life. I believed in getting to the point that as much as I was a reader, I wanted, you know, brevity, and I didn't have the patience, I thought, to write anything elongated. But this was my attempt to create something different in the genre of psychological suspense. If I was going to write something, I didn't want to just write a story. I wanted to accomplish certain specific things, and first, I wanted it to be different. I wanted person to pick the book up and say, you know what, whether I like it or not, I've never quite read anything like this before. So one of the first things that I wanted to do, only because I like the genre of suspense and terror and horror, it's just something I enjoy, I wanted to write something that would scare just about anyone. Not with overt graphic violence, but something more subtle, but that would terrify anyone. The second thing I wanted to be able to do is I wanted to use words and write a story that would bring the hardest hearts to tears. I wanted to make people feel. And if I could, again, I not only wanted to tell a story, but I wanted to try to make my words beautiful. You know, I believe in the power of ideas. I believe in the power of words. And I try to make them beautiful when I can. And maybe that's because I believe that their power to reach us, you know, really lies in their beauty. More than anything else, I wanted to try to discover for myself and then try to convey to others the essence, the center, the core of true horror. And I think that I found that first for myself, and I think that I was able to convey that. But this is an unconventional book. It is jolting in its style, in its content. I like to say that it should carry a warning label. I mean, sometimes the storyline will seem as if it's only an excuse for the tale of where the real terror of the book lies, which is in the mind of the main character. But there is a story, of course, and it centers on the main character, Richard Goodman. And Richard Goodman is an administrator for a school that teaches disabled people, mostly paraplegics, the art of watchmaking. So there is first a stark glimpse there, not only into the Lilliputian world of the watchmaker, but also into lives of people with physical disabilities. Now, Goodman can be described generally as a psychic, but he's a psychic that is being driven mad by his own inimitable gifts. He has no control over his powers. Now, some of the themes that I use are familiar things, but mixed with the unfamiliar. Goodman is plagued by dreams where he believes demons come to him at night and invade his nightmares. The dead will pay him a visit at any time, but they pay him a visit for a very specific reason, or so he believes. He believes that each time they do, even though they may terrify him, they don't always, but even though they may terrify him, they are trying to convey a message from something or someone that he believes he has to hear. But despite the abilities that he may have, Goodman is to acquire one more ability, and he also acquires a prophecy that is delivered by a seaside fortune teller. And the prophecy is that he has only 3 days to live. Goodman doesn't quite know what to make of this prophecy, but the clock of his life, nevertheless, begins to count down. And as it does, a greater threat emerges. And that threat is in the form of an assassin who is trying to destroy everyone he knows and everyone he loves, unless he can discover who the killer is and stop him in time. And that's generally what the Visions is about.
Wow. Is there any chance you could do an audio book on that? You're very intense.
depending on the questions you ask, you'll get mirth on the one hand, Bruce, or you'll get intensity. You know, the life of a writer is a life of solitude and respect. And I've always, in one respect, I've been that kind of person, even though I've lived a very public life in many respects. And certainly as an attorney, you can't exactly be shot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I've been thinking about things for a very long time, and I have some answers, and I have a lot of questions too. So in this book, you see answers and you see questions.
One of the things that if I read a book like this, I might have nightmares, something like that. Is that happened to a horror writer? When you're in the midst of a book like this, do you find yourself having nightmares and things like that?
I don't, actually. And, there have been, there's one specific time where I actually had a nightmare, and I rushed downstairs in the middle of the night, and I wrote it all down, and it became the centerpiece of the next novel that I'm working on right now, called Text
Wow.
Message. But what I'm doing when I'm writing horror, even though, listen, I start working at 5 a.m. in the morning, and it's dark outside typically when I start working, and it's quiet, as you could possibly imagine. And I have to tell you, I get scared by what I write sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's not what's in my nightmares. It doesn't give me nightmares. I'm getting scared about what I'm writing, but I'm also expunging the terror from me. I'm taking terror that I suppose, is a bit personal perhaps, but the horror that lives in my mind from real things, not from made-up things. And I'm taking it and I'm lifting it out of my brain and I'm removing it from myself and I'm putting it down in words so that I can look at it. I'm actually taking the terror out of me and I'm putting it somewhere else and I'm looking at it. So that's why I wrote Snapshots right after I wrote Visions. I had all the terror out of me for a while, and all I had was a few gags and giggles left.
Fascinating. You mentioned your central character, Richard Goodman. Now, how did you develop his character, and maybe we could even make that broader, how do you, in general, develop characters for a book like Visions?
Well, you know, that's again, it's an interesting question. I mean, and I suppose that one of the questions that you can get out of that is, when is an author just writing a story? When is he just sitting and making stuff up? How much of what he writes is based on something that is real? You know, when is he writing about himself? You know, I must tell you that, with some hesitation, that for a very long time, and remember, it was over a 10-year period, 10 drafts of this book, and then 3 more with my editor. It started out as a very, very long book, and cut to shreds later on. I looked at Richard Goodman as myself. I would sit at a dinner table day after day, week after week, year after year, talking about this book. And when I talked about this book, I didn't say Richard Goodman did this. I would say I said this. I did this. I became Richard Goodman for a very, very long time. And it was literally years before I could make a distinction between myself and him, and then kind of let the character go so that he could become, you know, what he needed to be, what he was supposed to be. I put him down on paper, and, you know, I'm not the only writer that said this, and after a time, the characters kind of tell me, you know, where they want to go. Mm-hmm. But when I write, I have a certain method that I write fiction, and it's this. I like to combine the familiar with the unfamiliar. There is nothing unique about a psychic. There is nothing unique about a man who sees the dead. These are very familiar themes to people. Mm-hmm. And I like to base my novels in part on familiar themes and then mix in the unfamiliar. But more than that, I like to blend fact with fiction. You know, C.S. Lewis, many, many, many years ago, wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, and where he's talking essentially about the devil. And he says that the devil is persuasive because he mixes lies with the truth, fact with fiction. And that was something that always stuck in my head. And I believe that the amalgamation of fact with fiction, so that reality becomes blurred. There are things that are factual in this book. There are things that actually happened in this book, even some of those things that are supernatural. I told you that I worked in schools. Once upon a time, I was hired as a public relations director for an internationally recognized school called the Joseph Bulova School that was founded by the grandfather of Joseph Bulova, who was the founder of the Bulova Watch Company, and his son actually took up the mantle and founded this school. This is a school in New York City that was founded for disabled war veterans. It founded wheelchair sports in America many, many years ago. I worked at that school for 4 years. The school that forms the setting for Visions Through a Glass Darkly is exactly the same as that school. The characters, many of the characters in this book were based on people who really existed. Some of the things that I describe in the book actually happened. Of course, you know, this is a fictional story. Mm-hmm. But I begin by mixing in my own mind absolute reality and laying over absolute fiction. And to me, this is what makes something compelling. If the reader can recognize that I'm doing this, it has a very disorienting effect. You don't know what's real and what isn't. And in my subsequent works, you're going to see this more and more.
Hmm. Fascinating. Again, we're speaking with David Abulafia. He's the author of the new book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly. Now, in your book, David, you talk about the wave. What is that and how does it work?
Well, the wave is one of the powers that Richard Goodman has. And, I tell you this? Well, suffice it to say that I've just mentioned that some of the things in this book are quite real, even one or two of the minor supernatural things that I describe. The wave is simply this. Every now and again, without his being in control of it at all, Richard Goodman will face a person for one reason or another. He becomes overwhelmed by what he calls a wave, like a wave falling over him, where he feels everything that the person in front of him is thinking, what they're about to do, what is in their heart, not with words, but with emotions. In a moment, he is overwhelmed by their personality and everything that is in their heart. And in essence, he knows who they are. He knows what they're thinking. He knows what they're going to do. It doesn't last. But again, he is a victim of his own powers. He can't control this, and he never knows when this is going to occur. And this is one of the things that is driving him mad. And this is a guy who is on the border of sanity and insanity.
Now, as you said before, as you alluded to, some of this book is fiction and some of this book is fact. So I want to focus on the fiction part of it. How did the fictional part of Visions Through a Glass Darkly come to you? Where did this idea come from?
Boy, you know what? I can only say this. I suppose it all starts with me having something to say that is beyond a mere story. So the story for me is almost secondary. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm always going to write this way, but with Visions, this was certainly the case. I'm trying to tell people something. At least I believe I have something to say. I start with real events, and they take off from there. The story begins to take a life of its own. Now, I have to tell you, with this book and with some of the others that I'm working on, the very first thing that I did with this is I wrote the beginning and I wrote the end, meaning I knew where I was starting and I knew where I was ending. And everything in between, I wasn't quite sure where it was going. So the way I wrote this book was from both ends towards the middle, a very strange way to write, but that's how I did it. And of course, when you reach the middle, then you have to connect the two parts, okay, which was another task that it just fell upon me. But I guess I really don't have an answer to that, Bruce. As I said, you know, when you start to create characters and you start to give them a personality, you kind of set them walking down a road, and you almost lose control of them after a while. Mm-hmm. They begin to become almost real, to have a life of themselves. They do what is consistent with the personality you created. And that's the best answer I could give you.
Yeah. In other words, they take control.
They do.
In your opinion, what makes a great horror story?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I can tell you this. I like to think that I'm a very disciplined writer. Mm-hmm. And I am not going to let anything go, not one page, not one paragraph, until I think it's the very best that I'm capable of doing. Visions, I worked on one paragraph for 4 hours once. Okay, one paragraph over and over, just a few lines of words, until I could say to myself, that makes me happy. So the first thing is, it has to make me happy. I have to at least say in my own mind, that's great writing. Now, I never know if anyone is going to agree. And I don't know if it even matters. I don't know if they're going to agree. You know, to me though, a great story and a great book, two different questions in a way. A great book has to touch us in some way to be memorable. I truly believe that it's not just the story. It has to change us. A book has to make us want to somehow keep those words alive in us, just as when we would walk down the street and whistle a familiar tune to ourselves. More than telling the story, does the author have something to say? Not just a tale, not just a bedtime story. Does he have something that he wants to say to you? Are the words beautiful? Do they touch you deep inside? Do they make you think? Do they make you ask questions? Questions that maybe he doesn't have any answers to. Does it make you feel? Does it touch your heart? Can you read a fantasy, a made-up story, that leaves us with a greater appreciation and understanding of reality? That's what I think great horror story should be. At least that's what I try to create.
And you know, it's interesting. I've interviewed songwriters and various other types of artists, and they basically say a lot of the same things that you just said, where it's if it resonates with them, then they just put it out there. Because if they think it's good, that's really, for them, it's like they know inside, this is my best work. You know, this is coming straight from my heart. Now, again, the book is Visions Through a Glass Darkly by David Abulafia. Now, David, You talked about how you write and you write throughout the day and you start at 5 a.m. So we know that many hours of the day you write, but do you have a certain writing rituals that you do? For example, things you do every day when you write?
You know, the only thing that I really do that you call a ritual is that I try to be disciplined enough that I wake up at a certain time and I write for a certain amount of hours, okay? And typically I'll write, at 5 a.m. But that can change dramatically, and it really depends on the mood that hits me. You know, sometimes every writer has some kind of block, okay, or reaches a stumbling point. And sometimes you really need to step away and then come back to something. But as I said, I've been known to wake up in the middle of the night and go down and write a paragraph. I've been known to just stop a television program and go inside and write one line because it occurs to me. So, you know, wherever I go, there's going to be a computer, whether it's in my office or in my home. And at any moment, at any time of the day or the night, 7 days a week, you can find me writing. Sometimes it'll be a little bit, and sometimes I'll just burn out on something until I can't go anymore. So that's about it. I write as the mood strikes me, and when I have something to say, I like it to come naturally. I never want my writing to be forced. And while you do have to be disciplined and you have to kind of get through stuff, I don't believe in rushing my writing along. I want it to come naturally. And when it does, that's when my best writing comes out.
Now, here's a dark subject that your book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly, covers. Do you believe that demons are real?
Well, I suppose that the short answer would be this. Of course they are. Mm-hmm. But we begin the conversation really by asking, what do we mean by that word?
Yeah.
So if we use the word demon, here's the three questions, I suppose, that I would ask. What do they look like? Where are they? What is their nature? What do they look like? Where are they? And what is their nature? All right, now, before we just go into the theological realm, let me say this. Most of the characters in Visions, no matter how different they are, all have something similar in common. They have something in common. They are all haunted by what each one of them refers to as demons. But these things mean different things to the different characters, even though they are all haunted by the same things. These are just things, events, people that haunt them. These very nebulous, we'll just call them things or concepts now, they have an object, and the object is always the same. And maybe this is the essence of what a demon is, to change their host. Supposedly against their will, or ultimately with their cooperation. For every character, their concept of what is a demon is a little different. Now, Richard Goodman sees a world where there are three kinds of demons. And essentially, you could say that I believe this in a sense. The first kind of demon are those that are very familiar to all of us. These are demons of flesh and blood. These are people who walk this earth just like you and I, and these are people whose specific occupation and object it is to do nothing but harm to other people, flesh and blood demons. Then there are the demons that attack Richard Goodman in his dreams. He's not sure what these things are, but they're the same every time. These are some kind of beings that come to him 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and they have an object. What is their object? Their specific object is to change his perception, to change his view of the world. These demons want to make him see a world that is terrifying, that is devoid of hope, that is a world that contains only darkness. They seek to change him in his dreams. But there is a third kind of demon, and that third kind is the source of what haunts Goodman in his nightmares. But these demons are not the product of his mind. These demons exist. So we go back to the three questions that I originally posed. What do they look like? Well, they look the way we believe they should, as we perceive them to be, because in my mind they are capable of infinite change. They will adapt themselves to us, to what we expect them to be. Where are they? I don't know. Over there, somewhere outside, I don't know where they are, and I don't try to explain it. And third, what is their nature? We are their nature. We create them. And if we don't create them, then we simply feed them. We empower them. We enable them. We sustain them. We give them what they need to survive. And that's the concept of demons in my dark brain and in this novel.
Thought-provoking, very thought-provoking. You know, what's interesting about that is you were talking about their adaptability and what are they. And you have science that would never see them, never see at least these types that are invisible entities, if you will. And yet you also have the other side, the religious side that probably sees demons everywhere. And we're probably talking about at times somewhere in the middle. But having said all that, they almost always will be able to operate covertly, because as a whole, as society as a whole, we will never really, quote unquote, see them. Do you agree?
Well, yes and no. You know, it's funny. In the 13th century, if a person, the concept of a virus was something that was unseen, something that you couldn't see that just made a person ill or crazy or whatever. Maybe this was a demon in the 13th century. Today, a virus is no more unseen to us than a daffodil growing in our garden, you know. Do human beings carry with them some kind of unseen aura that they're surrounded by? Well, there's something called the imagery, familiar with the Curlian photography. It purports to show us that aura as a photograph, as something real, even though it is unseen. Here is the point. Perception and the quality of perception is very relevant in this book and very relevant to my thinking. What is purportedly part of an unseen world, a so-called unseen world, changes with the quality of our perception. Sometimes it merely changes with our science, but it always has something to do with what goes on in our brains. You know, the physiological study of perception is a fascinating subject. When you compare, for instance, in scientific books, we're not talking about philosophy, the perception of a dog and the perception of a human being, a dog sees a world that is very different than a man. Hmm. When a dog, when my poodle, my 80-pound poodle, sits out in the backyard and puts his nose up into the air, he's smelling the rabbit. It's 20 feet in the bushes that I can't see. He's smelling the rabbit that was there last week, and he's smelling the rabbit that's a mile away that's coming towards my house. With his nose, a dog smells the present, the past, and the future. All of these things being unseen and unknowable to us, but as plain as day to a dog. When our perception changes, our world changes. What is unseen becomes seen. Richard Goodman is a man with a heightened perception who simply sees things with his eyes, through his eyes, that you and I may not be capable of seeing.
Hmm. And Richard Goodman is part of the new book, Visions Through a Glass Darkly, by David Abulafia. Now, David, in your description of the book, you wrote, "This novel is not just designed to terrify you, which it may do, but it is intended to change you. In what way do you hope this book changes the reader?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Bruce. It's funny because as you're talking, you're just reminding me what it is that I wrote in this book. When I was a very young man, a teenager, I became fascinated with the concept of change, and it was something that I studied really my entire life and continue to this day. And of course, the concept of change is, I believe, integrally related to the concept of perception. Now, I was, at that time, and I remain a very faulty person. I am a simp. I am imperfect. With that knowledge, I came to believe ultimately that the understanding of my life boiled down to two questions, just two questions. And they are these. I think they're the most important questions that anyone could ever ask. Not why is the sky blue, not is there a devil or a God. Here are the important questions. Why are we the way that we are? That's the first question. And the second question is, how can we get to from where we are to where we need to be, to where we want to be? These are the questions that I'm concerned about. This is what Richard Goodman, a man who is not in control of his life, or so he believes, these are the questions that he asks. So as my readers are entertained, I want them to think. It's not going to be painful. I want them to question their beliefs. I want them to open their minds to other possibilities that they could not imagine existed. And I also want to show them, I want to bring them into the dark world of Richard Goodman. There's a little darkness in just about all of us, and sometimes that darkness can overwhelm us. So I want to show people how easily a man can fall into an abyss. Mm-hmm. And that's an abyss composed of desperation, of sadness, and of loneliness, and of isolation. And that's the essence of horror to me. The essence of horror is when a man feels that he is alone in the world. So as I show them the abyss, and as I show them the man who has fallen into the abyss, I also want to show them how they can climb out of it. And I also want to tell them and show them and get them to think about what may happen if they don't.
Is there anything you're currently working on? And can you give us a little teaser if there is?
Oh, sure. I have to tell you that once I wrote Visions, the floodgates just opened up. That I wrote Snapshots. I've actually just completed my third book, which is a sequel to Snapshots, called Just More Snapshots for My Uneventful Life. That's in the editing process right now. It's funny. Visions took me 10 years. The first Snapshots book took me 8 months, and the second one took me 9 months. Now I have in front of me, Bruce, and I don't know, I hope you don't think I'm nuts, but I'm working on four books simultaneously.
Wow.
Okay. And I do this, I'll get ideas for a novel, and I'll write a page or two. And if it's a page or two and then it dies, it's just an idea, it's not a book. But if I write three or four pages, or five or six pages, that's a book. Mm-hmm. If I write the beginning and the end of something, that's a book. So I have four books that I am working on simultaneously. One of them is the sequel to Visions, which I'm actually halfway through, called Again Dark Visions. But I went halfway through, I wrote the ending, I put it on the shelf because I got distracted by something else. I got distracted by a book called Text Message, which is a little bit more of a commercial horror, a little bit more, not completely as intense as Vision was, more in the Dean Koon style. I'll tell you in a moment, but I'm hoping that this is going to be completed this year. And this is essentially three people in three cities are stalked by a killer who telegraphs his intentions with the same five-word text message. And all these three people are linked by a dream that they share and a terrifying event that they experienced years ago. You may remember I told you earlier that once upon upon a time I woke up in the middle of the night and I had this crazy dream.
Yeah.
And I wrote this dream down. Well, that's the foundation of text message. Now, I wrote this damn thing down. I mean, it's a wild dream, Bruce.
Yeah.
And it's full of symbolism. I knew when I wrote this that this dream, that this one that I attributed now to one particular character, was going to be the entire foundation of this book. And it is. It's packed with symbolism. I just haven't figured it out yet. Okay, so that's text message. Text message is about 20% complete. Then I started two other books. One is called Cold Storage, and one is called Heartbreak Hotel, which is, of course, was a song and was, other books by the name of Heartbreak Hotel, but I couldn't resist the title. Just going to Heartbreak for a second, this is going to be a great one. This is going to be a very, very intense book. This is a book about redemption, essentially. And it is based, again, consistent with what I told you, it is based on two hotels in New York City. One is called the Hotel Chelsea, and the other is called the Hotel Albert, which closed many years ago. Both of these were very eclectic hotels where very famous people and artists, writers and musicians congregated over the years. And they're kind of famous / infamous places in New York City. So what I did is I began to research these two hotels. And I took from them that Dylan Thomas met Thomas Wolfe. Walt Whitman wrote poetry in one of these hotels. The novel You Can't Go Home Again was written. Eric Clapton jammed in the basement of the Albert Hotel with a group then in its infancy called Cantique. So I took all of these real instances, and then I began to create a hotel that never really existed. And the book covers essentially goes from the 1870s to 2044 is essentially the time span of this hotel, focusing on approximately a 70-year period in this hotel's life and the things that go on in this hotel. Cold Storage is a project in its infancy, which was actually supposed to precede Heartbreak Hotel. Cold Storage is based on the hospital where I was born, which is the now demised St. Vincent Hospital, which still just so happened to be around the corner in Greenwich Village, New York City, from the Hotel Albert. Again, a real place with a very illustrious 150-year history. So we start with what was a real place. And now I must tell you, before I start to ramble, you know, because I only have one horror novel under my belt, that's all you're going to see from now on is psychological suspense and horror. I have an opportunity to do something somewhat unique. Every book that I write is going to be related, meaning that characters from one book are going to appear in the next book. Places from one book are going to appear in the next. You know, in text message, the hospital that is the subject of Cold Storage is mentioned. And it's going to appear ultimately as if I've written only one story. It just continues to go on and on. You know, I'll mention just one thing about text message, because it's something that is new and it's rather a little jolting. In my town that I live in, which is about 40-odd miles north of New York City, there was a kid in my town by the name of Harrison Apar. Harrison Apar was what would put the politically correct manner called a little person. He was a dwarf. Mm-hmm. At the age of 15, he was 3 feet tall and 38 pounds. He became a very famous figure in this little town because he was a very special kid, and this kid died at the age of 15 from his underlying condition. His father, who I know personally, was very changed by this, and continues to be changed to this day. And when I was writing Text Message, the book, I came to a point where the book needed something. I needed something in this book, and I had an idea, and I called up my friend Bruce, and I had a rather teary-eyed lunch with him. And this is what I said to him. I want to learn everything there is to know about your son. And I want to take him, and I want to put him in my book. I want to put him into my book as he was in real life. Now, I'm going to take his real life, his real personality, his size, everything he did, and I'm going to alter it. I'm going to change it, but I'm going to start with what was a real person. And I'm going to dedicate this book to him. I'm going to make him the hero of this book. Then I'm going to bring him back in other books. This kid, this poor kid, had a tremendous story and affected the lives of literally of thousands of people in this town. They've named it Lake Fields after him. And a decade after he died, there are people in this town who are still talking about this kid who only lived 15 years, who had such a burden to carry, but was such an amazing kid. And, of course, the way I write it, Harrison Apoff, being physically disabled, is a student at the Waterman School, the Waterman School being the focus of my first novel. So I'm going to put Harrison down. That's why Text Message is starting to take off right now, thanks to Harrison. And I don't know, maybe this sounds a little strange to you, Bruce, or to your readers, but to me, this is what makes my stories visceral. This is what draws me into the stories, the combining of fact and fiction, and taking a world that I essentially view in many ways as being out of control and controlling it, putting it on a piece of paper, and maybe making a world that may be a little terrifying, but that essentially turns out right a good part of the time.
I like the unique touches that you're putting into your books, and I like the ideas that you've just expressed. I like a uniqueness to the way people do things. For instance, going back to Alfred Hitchcock, putting himself in his movies as cameos. I think there's a fascinating twist that you've got going in your book, your books. So I'm looking forward to those books, and I would love to have you back for those books as they come out. I want to remind our listeners, though, that the book we're talking about this week that's out right now is Visions Through a Glass Darkly. Again, it's by David Abulafia. Now, before we go, where, David, can people find you online?
Well, I have, of course, an author's Facebook page, which they could dig up. And of course, the book is on sale through Amazon and through Barnes and Noble and through a million other places. And I have an author's page on Amazon as well. On my Facebook page, you'll see excerpts from all my books, and you'll also see what are going to be the covers of all my books. Because one of the things I like to do to conceptualize the book is create the cover right away. And once I create the cover, it starts everything kind of going. So you'll see the covers, you'll see excerpts as they come, and as the books get created, you'll see more and more and more of them. So if you want to see all the crazy things that are banging around in my brain, Facebook is probably a good place to find me.
Great. And again, it's David Abulafia, and I'm going to spell that A-B-O-U-L-A-F-I-A, David Abulafia, and he's the author of Visions Through a Glass Darkly. David, this has been awesome, and we'll have you back.
No, thank you, Bruce, and thank you to your listeners. It was very, very kind of you to have me on.
Thank you.